6 minutes now past 12 o'clock. And good afternoon. Welcome back to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Well, all eyes remain focused on Florida today, where the official recount of Tuesday's presidential election continues. The unofficial recount, as reported by the Associated Press, finds George W. Bush still holding a lead over Al Gore, but the lead has shrunk to 327 votes. An official result is not expected to be announced until next Tuesday, but even then, the actual vote total in Florida won't be known until at least next Friday, when Florida's overseas absentee ballots are added to the total. Then, of course, there are all the legal challenges that are either underway or being talked about, and the rhetorical war that's broken out between the Gore and Bush campaigns. Well, we'll keep you posted on all the latest developments on the recount. But meanwhile, we've been joined today by one of the biggest winners here in Minnesota on Tuesday, Senator-elect Mark Dayton. No recount necessary in that race. Mr. Dayton defeated incumbent Republican Rod Grams 49% to 43% in Tuesday's election. Senator-elect Mark Dayton is our guest this hour, and if you have a question or comment for soon-to-be Senator Dayton, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. By the way, we should note that a program called A Common Place that we've been promoting for this hour, we're going to have that on at noon on Monday. Well, Senator Dayton, congratulations.
Well, thank you, Gary. I'm still getting used to that, the senator-elect anyway. I'm just keep looking over my shoulder to see who you're talking to. But it's a thrill.
Before we get into our conversation here, I can't let the moment pass. What do you think ought to be done down in Florida? What should the presidential candidates be doing right now?
Well, my two teenage sons would have a one-word admonition to them and their campaigns, which would be chill. I think that they need to back off all this rhetoric. This is, you know, basically being conducted like a continuation of their campaigns, and it's really got to change, or you know, we're not going to have an outcome, and whoever prevails is not only going to be lacking a mandate, they're going to be lacking any credibility or even respectability to lead this country. So if ever we needed a council of elders, right now would be the time, and in the absence of that, I thought maybe we should ask, or get President Clinton representing Vice President Gore and Governor Jeb Bush representing his brother, or at least James Baker and Warren Christopher, if they're the designated, agree between themselves, if the candidates agree on the process by which this is going to be resolved. It seems that legally the ballots that are going to be collected over the next week, absentee ballots in Florida, have to be counted by next Friday, and then ideally just have them all agree that whatever that result is next Friday, that will be the conclusion, and whoever loses, he'll have an opportunity probably to distinguish himself even more than the winner if he concedes honorably and follows that process. Otherwise, I think we're going to be in an electoral swamp that's going to be really damaging, and who knows where it'll end.
So wait till next Friday, and then...
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't understand right. Florida law, but as I understand it, legally, those absentee ballots... I mean, this whole situation cries out for a fundamental overhaul of our electoral system for federal elections. To have this much of an anomaly, and it's always going to be imperfect, but to have every state, every county conducting and using their own different ballots, everything else, I mean, this is just evidence that we're really outdated. But it's not going to help us resolve this one, and we just need to, I think, come to a conclusion at the earliest possible legal date so that this country can proceed.
Are you surprised to find yourself sitting here as the next senator from the state of Minnesota? I mean, after all, you ran back in 82, you lost, but more recently you ran for governor just 2 years ago and didn't do so well. And I think it's fair to say that not very many people expected that you'd be running this year, to say nothing of winning. Are you surprised?
Well, 2 years ago I certainly would not have imagined I'd be sitting here today. When I started this campaign, decided to undertake it 7 months ago, I believed that I could win. I didn't know I would. I said then it was the best opportunity I had, and would be the best opportunity I'd likely ever have. So this was the time for me, and it turned out every bit as well as I expected, and probably even better than I might have predicted at the time.
When did you first start thinking about, or seriously thinking about, running this year?
Well, the beginning of this year is really probably January, February was when I first started to consider it and saw the lay of the land, the field of candidates. And March started to really seriously think about it. I came to a conclusion in my own mind just early March that I was going to do it and thought about it, talked with a few trusted friends and advisors for the next few weeks. And then I think it was April 3rd that I went over and said at the Capitol that I was going to be a candidate, and I've just carried it ever since. I certainly, you know, knew that people would be surprised and skeptical. I knew I'd have to prove myself to everyone, but I'm not a frivolous person, as I said back then, and once I decided to undertake it, I was absolutely going to give it all that I possibly could, and knew that I would have to, that it was a tough field, DFL, and it's never easy to beat an incumbent senator. In fact, I was told by the Democratic Senate Committee last spring that only in the last 10 years, only 5 incumbent Republican senators have been defeated for re-election. So I knew it was a huge undertaking, and I decided I was going to give it my best.
When did you come up with the idea to launch a really significant ad campaign in the middle of the summer? I'll underline that because for people who don't follow these things very closely, that's pretty much unheard of. Candidates, if they do much advertising, all wait till right before the primary, and then the assumption being that's when voters are paying attention. But you were running a lot of ads right through the summer, and moved to the front of the field and never lost your lead. It was a brilliant strategy. Everybody seems to agree on that.
Well, yes, I would qualify that only by saying that by my poll in June and by Mike Cerisi's just a couple weeks before that, in the DFL field after the convention, I had started out ahead. In my poll, I had 25%, and his poll, 23%. The other next was about 17%. So I started out with that based on, I believe, earned support over my previous years of public service and running statewide. But you're right, Gary. I saw an opportunity. My assessment, and I was working collaboratively with a pollster and my media consultants and my own campaign organization, and I just thought it was, once I started, I wanted to be able to run continuously up through the primary with media, and we backed it out, and right after the 4th of July, with 9 weeks to go, we started, and I was surprised, frankly, that there was no one else doing the same, because it seemed to me that it's obvious that while people are living their lives in the summer away from meetings and those kind of things, that people are watching television and watching the nightly news, and so it was a good opportunity, and my media folks agreed that, you know, we needed to reintroduce me and let people know sort of who I was and what I've been doing with my entire career, and just started there, and it really was a vacuum there that I was able to fill.
Critics say the only reason you won is because you spent so much money. What do you think is the single biggest reason that you were elected senator?
Well, certainly my ability to finance my own campaign was a very big advantage, but I was spent in the primary the same amount as one of my opponents, and in general, the technical, the numbers, $7 million that Senator Graham's campaign raised in the election cycle, the $11 million, a little over that of mine, but to me that isn't the whole story. He has a tremendous benefit of the incumbency, as a franking privilege, he uses perfectly legally, but he has a whole staff out in Washington, policy and the like. I mean, the advantages of an incumbent are huge on either side of the aisle. Plus, he had the Republican National Committee, Senate Committee, State Republican Party, all spending money, which has not been disclosed in terms of its amount. I would guess it was easily a couple $1 million total with the mailings and the ad TV ads and the like and the production costs. And so, I mean, I view it as essentially a level battleground between the two of us. And, you know, is there too much? Do they cost too much? Yes. If the TV stations and other media outlets would discount their rates by half, well, it'd be half the cost would be almost reduced in half, because about 80% of my costs were producing and putting out paid media. But that's how you communicate with people. And we're not going to change that system unless we get out there and have people really willing to do so. And this present Congress has not.
Mm-hmm. Well, setting aside the money issue, was there one thing you think that really made a big difference?
Well, I think my positions on the issues that Minnesotans cared about were closer to the mainstream Minnesota values, and people want government to play a constructive role. They want it to be limited. They want to lower taxes, certainly, but they also don't want to just turn everything that government does over to the private sector, whether it be medical care or pension, retirement benefits, like. So there's more of a balance there, and I think I was closer to that balance than Rod Graham's.
One other question before we get to the listener calls here, kind of a hangover from the campaign, the general election campaign. You were frequently complained about the what you said were personal insults, attacks, and so on from the Graham's campaign. Any lingering bitterness there?
No, not on my part. The campaign is over, and I'm very, very fortunate to have won. I never thought it would be easy, and I never expected it to be even fun or pleasant, and most of the time it wasn't. I think in hindsight, my analysis would be that he hurt himself more than he hurt me, and I think that would be a good warning for future campaigns in Minnesota, that that kind of assault is still in balance and not viewed favorably by the electorate.
Minnesota Senator-elect Mark Dayton is our guest this hour. We have a full bank of callers, so let's get to some of those callers with questions for now Senator-elect Dayton. Mark, go ahead, please.
Mr. Dayton, during your campaign, one of your primary promises was to deliver health care for all workers, which I think is full of pure motives of perhaps lacking in political economic sense of reality. But my question is, what do you think your chances as a freshman senator, given the current condition of Congress and the presidential situation, of actually having any chance of delivering on that promise?
Well, I think your question has all the elements of the answer. You're right. I'm going to be a very junior-most senator in a very closely divided Congress with whichever administration, and I think collaboration, bipartisanship is going to be essential to accomplish anything at all, which and there certainly is not that consensual support for even the notion of universal health care in this country, much less a way to get there. So I'm going to advocate for it. I'm open to work with those others in the Senate who are looking for a constructive solution, which I think eventually this country needs. But I'm open to how best to accomplish that, and I'm realistic enough to know it's not likely to happen in this immediate future. I think the prescription medicine coverage for seniors through some system or another is an acute need and is recognized as such, and I think that's an area where, starting in January, the Congress will hopefully, and the new administration will work out something that's agreeable to both parties.
In terms of prescription drugs, if the Republicans come up with a plan, which they seem to have favored in the past, one really targeted to the lowest of low-income seniors, would you be willing to support that as an incremental step, perhaps, to broader coverage?
Oh, absolutely. Whatever they is done should be voluntary, and it certainly should be targeted toward those who are most impoverished and also those who have the highest percentage of their incomes going to prescription medicine expenses. So there's a way to work that out, and as I say, it's going to have to be the middle ground or it's not going to happen at all.
Why do you suppose it's been so hard for people on both sides of the political aisle to get together on some of these things? There does seem to be, in almost all of these issues, at least a fairly narrow area of agreement, which would make, I suppose, some improvement in what is perceived to be a problem. But it seems like both sides kind of dig in, and they want their solution or there won't be any.
Well, you're right, Gary. And as I said, I think the mandate of the people in this election, given that it's so closely divided, both the House and the Senate and the administration hanging by a thread either way, that, you know, the public seems to me is saying steady as she goes down the present course, and let's keep the economy improving and make some improvements, but no radical departures. I mean, it's hard, I think, in the last 6 months or 8 months, even before a national election, especially a presidential year, to get the kind of bipartisan compromise necessary, because both parties are trying to get things done, but they're also trying to score as many political points, and a lot of that jockey maneuvering is just takes over as the election gets closer. Now, I think, and we'll see what the post-election Senate and the administration and the House, if it comes back, could work out. But whatever's left to be done starting next January with a new Congress and new administration, I think the American people expect and have a right to expect that we're going to make some real progress in these areas that they're concerned about. And if we don't, I think it'll be at the peril of everybody. So I think, you know, for the at least the year and a half or year and 9 months following this election, the parties and the elected officials, leaders, need to work together.
Next question from Duluth. Wayne, go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is actually a two-part question. One, what committee assignments would you like to be on? And two, what legislation would you like to propose your first year out?
Okay.
Good questions, Wayne. I'm going out to Washington next Monday on the assumption that if the early bird catches the worm, I want to be out there as early as possible. And my first request will be the Senate Agriculture Committee. Second would be the Senate Aging Committee. And the third would be the Senate Appropriations Committee, sort of all the A's. And I think I have a reasonable chance that the first two appropriations, I'm told, is going to be more difficult for a freshman senator. And part of it depends on what other senators with more seniority who may want to shift their committee assignments decide they want to do. So it's probably going to take a few weeks to sort itself out. But I'm going to start with those requests. And in terms of legislation, the two specific pieces of legislation I intend to try to develop and submit as soon as possible. One is on the campaign finance proposal I have been floating around the state during this campaign, since I'm suspect on that, and I think all incumbents really are, is to set up a national commission of 50 or so of the most distinguished Americans, like former Vice President Walter Mondale, former Governor Elmer L. Anderson, none of whom would hold a current office, who would be appointed to cover the entire spectrum of our country, and I'd have them go off and with one mandate, come back in a year with a system that would best serve the interests of all the people of this country and the future of democracy. And at that point, the Congress would have to vote it up or down, no amendments. The president would sign it or veto it. I think that's the only way, in fact and in perception, we're going to convince Americans that this is a campaign finance system that's going to represent their interests rather than the special interests or the incumbent's interests. And I, after the experience in Florida, would add to that, maybe they should also be looking at how we have a uniform system of federal elections, presidential, with a common set of ballots and counting procedures and life, so we never have to go through this nightmare again.
Part and parcel of big changes in the electoral system, you think we should keep the Electoral College?
Well, you know, that's going to be, I think, a hotly debated subject for the next year or so. It certainly raises questions. I'm not a constitutional expert nor an historian. I've certainly heard some plausible reasons why we should keep it. To me, the first lesson out of this is we need to have, as I said just before, a uniform, reliable, accurate system of counting the ballots in every state in the country so that we don't have, no matter what system we use, Electoral College or popular vote, I mean, we just cannot have a crisis of reliability wondering what the actual total was. And as others have written and said recently, you know, you could probably do a recount in every state in the nation and come up with different totals from what they were last Tuesday. It may not be perfect, but to have it be this imperfect, this idiosyncratic, to have, you know, Florida, even within from county to county, having different ballots and different procedures, and Washington State now they have some 650,000 votes that won't be counted for another week because there they are allowed to vote by mail even if they're living, residing in the state at the time. Florida, you know, allowing another week now for absentee ballots to trickle in. I mean, we haven't paid attention to this because it hasn't arisen, but I think our procedures are out of date and far more imperfect than they need to be in this advanced technological era, and we should, you know, we need to address that first and foremost.
Wendy, your question, please.
Yes. First of all, congratulations, Mr. Dayton.
Thank you, Wendy.
I would wondering, of course, we don't know the outcome of what this election is going to be, but it's a great time in history, I think. I'm wondering, I guess what swayed my vote more towards Gore was the fear of environmental issues with what's been going on in Texas and that information coming out. And I was wondering, do you think under a Bush administration, is there environmental threats, and what sorts of things would you do to help keep our wonderful environment in Minnesota and also across the nation intact?
Well, Wendy, I'm going to give either president, whoever he turns out to be, the benefit of the doubt. I think at this point, especially with everything hanging in the balance, that we ought to assume that either will proceed with good intentions, and I think we'll have to really proceed in the spirit of bipartisanship because neither is going to have a mandate. There's such a cloud hanging over this. The Senate could be 50-50. And so we're just going to have to proceed with a middle course. And if someone tries to depart from that, whether it be on environmental protection or anything else, I think that, you know, I just don't think they're going to get halfway off the down to first base. So Let's hope we'll continue. Minnesota has prided itself in having high environmental standards, and we need to assure that. We need to do it with the federal EPA providing more oversight but less restrictions, less mandates and reporting requirements. It's another thing I want to address as a senator, is to pare back all these duplicative, triplicative adjudicating agencies, federal, state, local, and the like.
Minnesota Senator-elect Mark Dayton is our guest this hour, and we are also, of course, keeping track on all the latest news out of Florida. And we heard earlier from James Baker, who was sent to Florida to represent the Bush campaign during the recount. Now the Gore people are responding to the Bush, or to the Baker comments, and let's pick up those comments. Here is the chair of the Gore campaign, William Daley.
Let me make a few comments regarding the ongoing vote count here in Florida before Secretary Christopher and I leave. We'll be stopping in Nashville. As you know, our campaign has been shut down as of today, and then we're on to Washington for the weekend. As you know, the automatic recount required by Florida law is continuing. To date, that count has shown a considerable narrowing of the margin between Vice President Gore and Governor Bush. When one considers the number of ballots yet to arrive from Americans overseas, and presumably mostly men and women in the military, it seems very clear that the outcome here in Florida remains in doubt, as it will for several more days. In addition, in the past 24 hours, three counties have granted requests to have ballots counted, hand-counted, at least on a sample basis. These requests were made because of oddities in the computer vote totals. I hope all Americans agree that the will of the people, not a computer glitch, should select our next president. The wait to get these results is frustrating. Frustrating to all of us in both campaigns, and to the American people, obviously, as well. But calls for a declaration of a victor before all the votes are accurately tabulated are inappropriate. Waiting is unpleasant for all of us, but suggesting that the outcome of a vote is known before all the ballots are properly counted is inappropriate. In addition, we continue to explore the questions of what can be done to remedy the unfairness of thousands of residents in Palm Beach County who believe they were voting for Al Gore, having those votes tabulated for Pat Buchanan, or not tabulated at all. Our legal team has concluded that the ballot in Palm Beach County, it was unlawful, it was complained about on Election Day, a complaint implicitly acknowledged by the election supervisor who put out a flyer on Election Day warning about the problems. In the end, as frustrating as this wait may be, what we are seeing here is a democracy in action, a careful and lawful effort to ensure that the will of the people is done. Our other systems of government may work faster. Curtailing voters' rights may get a result that is faster. But no system of government is more just or more enduring than ours. I hope that our friends in the Bush campaign will join us in our efforts to get the fairest and most accurate vote count here in Florida. Respect for democratic principles and for the fundamental precept of our Constitution that the people should decide requires no less. I think as we move forward, it is implicit for all of us and all of those concerned that we carefully measure all of our words, recognizing the high stakes involved in these deliberations. Secretary Christopher and I would be happy now to answer.
That was William Daley, who is the chair of the Gore campaign down in Florida, overseeing the recount of votes in Florida. As it stands right now, we will not know for sure just how many people voted for Al Gore or George W. Bush, presumably until next Friday, a week from today. We will continue our conversation with Senator-elect Mark Dayton, but right now let's catch up on some other news headlines. Here's Stephen John. Stephen?
Thank you very much, Gary. Bush spokesman James Baker says the Florida vote recount shows George W. Bush is the president-elect. Baker says the Bush camp will vigorously oppose the Gore camp's attempts to prolong the election through what he calls endless challenges. He again rejected complaints about the ballot in Palm Beach County, saying Democrats didn't question the ballot ahead of time. He says Gore should step aside. The presidential vote recount in Palm Beach County won't be certified until a court hearing is held on Tuesday. A judge issued an injunction barring the county from doing so in response to a legal challenge over what voters say is a confusing ballot design. Kicking off a victory tour of upstate New York, Senator-elect Hillary Rodham Clinton called for elimination of the Electoral College. The First Lady said she was ready to co-sponsor legislation seeking a constitutional amendment providing for direct popular election of the president. A decline in smoking means less money for smoking prevention efforts and medical education at the University of Minnesota. As part of the state's 1998 tobacco settlement, a projected $1.3 billion was set aside for endowments, but when tobacco companies shipped less product, their payments to the endowments went down. The University of Minnesota Duluth is considering capping its enrollment unless the school can get money to build more classrooms and faculty offices. Chancellor Catherine Martin says she fears substantial growth could mean making sacrifices in the quality of UMD undergraduate education. The forecast is calling for mostly cloudy conditions this afternoon. A chance of light snow or flurries, especially in the north. Highs in the upper 20s to upper 30s. A chance of light snow in the northwest tonight. And Saturday, a chance of light snow moving in from the west. That chance of snow will continue through the weekend for much of the southern part of the state, including the Twin Cities, where several inches of snow could fall. In Albert Lea this hour, 27 degrees. Bemidji has light snow and 27. Mankato's at 25, and it's 32 in the Twin Cities. That's the latest from the newsroom, Gary.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. It's about 28 minutes before 1 o'clock, midday on Minnesota Public Radio. And our guest this hour, Minnesota's new Senator-elect, Mark Dayton. And if you have a question for Mr. Dayton, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 2828. John, you're next. Go ahead, please.
Excuse me?
You're on the air.
It's a pleasure to speak with both of you today. Senator-elect Dayton, I have a question for you. I'm an avid sportsman, hunter, and firearm collector. My main purpose in owning them is enjoyment and passing that on to my children and the safety that is involved in that. My question is, will you compromise Minnesotans' rights to own and use and collect firearms by following the Democratic Party line rhetoric? I'll take my answer off the line.
Thank you, John, for your call. No, I will not compromise it. I stated my own position on this. I'm a gun owner myself, a hunter myself growing up, and I totally support the Second Amendment as well as the rights of Minnesotans to enjoy their lives as they have been. And, you know, there's no monolithic Democratic Party line. I know I'll have differences on this view from President Gore if he is the president, as I did with President Clinton. And but I made a promise to Minnesotans, particularly friends of mine all over the state who supported me and strongly support gun owners' rights, and I will not forsake my promise.
Is there any change in current gun laws that you would support that wouldn't, in your mind, infringe on gun owner rights?
Well, I don't know that we're going to be able to accomplish anything in this climate, as I said. But, you know, if there was, I think the waiting period that was put into place at the federal level corresponds to the one we have here in Minnesota for many years. I'd favor or support closing the loopholes there. But I'm not going to be an advocate for any legislation in this area at this point.
Hannah, your question, please.
Thank you for taking my call. Gary, first, I'd like to say that I have learned so much from your program concerning the politics. I thank you for everything.
Well, thanks for listening.
Yes. And then, Senator Dayton, a couple of things. I read an article about you in the St. Paul paper, and there was a marvelous quote that you from your father, something about a bum is bad, but a rich bum is worse.
The only thing worse than a bum is a rich bum.
Yes. And in my own life, I've been gifted with good economics. And so sometimes I feel for you in all the negative attitudes that people have concerning your economics. And so I'd like to say thank you for not becoming angry when you're constantly barraged with those comments. What I read and what you do with your money, I find very pleasing. However, my last comment, and I'd like you to comment about it, is where we are as a country right now is frightening in a way, especially in the political arena. I voted for you because of what you spoke about, policies and issues, but I also vote for who I think would represent things like being a leader for compromise and being a leader in the respect of all people, and especially within the Senate. Could you maybe comment on that, please? Thank you.
Okay. Well, Hannah, I'm honored by your vote. Thank you. And as no question that this is a period of time which requires compromise and collaboration, bipartisanship in order to accomplish anything. And as I said earlier on the show, people may disagree on exactly what the solution to some of these problems are, but I think that the mandate from the electorate was we want you to progress to make some changes, improvements, and find some solutions, and do so it's going to have to be in a bipartisan way. So that will be the test of my leadership abilities and everyone else's out there, and I hope to show Minnesotans that I'm equal to that.
Are you comfortable with your wealth? Have you been? Is that something that took a while to get used to or come to grips with? Or that comes up all the time, and so.
Well, I've gotten comfortable with the fact that it comes up all the time, Gary. I certainly come to accept that. You know, I started when I became politically aware back in college. You know, and then taught in New York City and lived with a welfare family in a public housing project, and realized that, you know, the stark contrast between the good fortune to which I'd been born and what these kids had come into through no choice or fault of their own, and that sense of the injustice of the great disparity of wealth in this country bothered me then, and it bothers me to this day. So I've had that inherent contradiction within myself for all my adult life. The reality is, after this campaign, I have a lot less wealth than I did when I started, and I, you know, still am relatively well off, but I had to make a huge commitment. In my mind, it was a demonstration of a commitment, and I did it intentionally, knowingly, and the like. So, you know, there is that, and there's disparity that was pointed out during the campaign. One of the questions here today, with the advantage I have been able to self-finance a campaign. So there are these inherent contradictions, but they're kind of interwoven into realities of our society that preceded my birth into this planet and will probably continue thereafter, and I have to wrestle with them as we do as a society, and I hope to play a constructive role in creating a better opportunity for everybody, while at the same time recognizing that this is the system that we have that does benefit to more people than not, and certainly compared to other economic systems around the world is unquestionably the one that's been most successful.
There is, not only in conjunction with your situation, but in general, a lot of talk about the disparities of wealth and so on. Is that something that people ought to be worried about in and of itself, or is it just a question of making sure that the people at the bottom are pretty comfortable?
Well, John Kennedy said a rising tide lifts all boats, but I think it lifts the yachts higher than the rowboats, and I think the disparity is not always recognized by a lot of people because it's hard to really understand or see firsthand how people at this, you know, mega level of hundreds of millions or billions or even multi-millions of dollars live their lives, and the kind of, you know, stock options now, and the kind of, you know, the reducing the capital gains rate, which the Republicans wanted to do again this summer, even further down to 15%, which would be the lowest rate at which, you know, working people are taxed. So we have these inequities, and they're being exacerbated, in my view, rather than mitigated. And that's where I would be in disagreement and in opposition to further attempts to make tax advantages to those who already have a lot of money and additional tax advantages going their way. So I just think we need to, as you said, certainly allow those. I believe we need, if we want this country to work for everybody, need to have an economic system where people can earn the American dream, where anybody who works full time, in my view, should not be poor, should be able to, you know, be at least get their family to the poverty level where they can then, through further training and advancement and effort, can achieve the American dream. We want to reinforce the work ethic. We want to take people off of the taxpayers' support systems. We want to move this country forward with productivity and new businesses, innovation. All that needs to be rewarded economically in order for us to succeed.
Pablo, your question, please.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question is regarding campaign reform. Mr. Dayton, you spent $12 million in order to defeat a heavily backed incumbent. And it seems to me that you have to be a celebrity or have a lot of money these days to run for office. My specific question is, what can be done to open the political process to the regular citizen?
Well, it's a very good question, Pablo. And I'll give an abbreviated answer to what I said earlier, which is I think we need a national commission to come back, because my view is going to be different from another incumbent senator and congressman. They're all going to be suspect because we have a real and perceived vested interest in some system or another. But no question we need to reform it. I personally think the Minnesota system of partial public financing for qualifying candidates it serves us well, races for governor and other offices, and I would certainly offer that to the nation as a starting point for a better model.
Tough, though, isn't it, to in your circumstance, and a lot of other people were elected this year or ran anyway, who were quite wealthy, and it can't be illegal for you to spend your own money. So what do you do about that?
Well, Minnesota, good point, Gary, but Minnesota has a way in which if you don't accept the partial public financing and the restrictions, then that money goes to your opponent. I mean, there are ways to work with that within the constitutional decision made back in the 1970s by the U.S. Supreme Court, which again, probably still allows for some attempts at modification. But you know, the last figure I saw, over $3 billion was spent this year in all of the elections nationwide. I mean, I think that's probably an understatement, because we'll never know how much some of these groups that don't have to report. I think the you know, having limits on so-called federal hard money contributions and expenditures, while you have unlimited amount of money, soft money, I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe millions of dollars that were put in by individuals or companies or interest groups. I mean, the cost of mounting an effective campaign, I mean, I'm criticized for the amount I spent, but if you look at the scope of a statewide race such as this and the amount of other advertising of other campaigns, everything else, I mean, yeah, I had a strong presence, but I mean, it wasn't anything in my view that, and according to the rating points that we were looking at, especially now with the multiplicity of stations, channels, everything, was not as high as 18 years ago. So, you know, we need a system where we put some rationality back into it, where we have better accountability, where we lower the cost by discounting rates, and most of all by having a financing system which, as you said, Pablo, does permit anybody to run for office, and that's got to be the bottom line.
Darren, you're next. Your question for Senator-elect Dayton, please.
Yes, congratulations, Mr. Dayton. I really am glad that you got into the office that you're in.
Thank you, Darren.
I voted for you in both the primary and in the general election, and I also have been a convention delegate to the DFL State Convention, and my question of you that does relate somewhat to the funding issue that you've just been addressing is, do you think that the endorsement process and the primary process that we have in Minnesota needs to be altered to reflect the will of the majority of the Democrats around the state? And further than that, do you think that there's something wrong with the primary system that we have around the country, where certain states seem to be more controlling of who the final candidate is than, say, the presidential election? And I'll just hang up and listen to your response.
Well, thank you for your support, Darren, and excellent questions. You know, in a democracy, elections are the way we decide the outcomes. So my view, the general election and the primary are the final arbiters of the party's final candidates and then the final victor. I've said for some time, I think our primary ought to be in early June. I think having a primary as late as we do handicaps challengers of all parties. And so I think that needs to be changed. I would personally believe that the party conventions serve a good purpose, and the grassroots process, the precinct caucuses in some form, although the number of people turning out for the caucuses has declined so drastically in both parties over the last 20 years, that I think that approach needs to be reconsidered. But if we had the endorsing conventions in the middle of the spring, middle of April or so, I think, in fact, the endorsed candidates would fare better, because you'd have the activists coming out with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of momentum, and they could work for 6 weeks and have the primary and then go enjoy the summer rather than trying to sustain it for 3 months over the summertime, which is almost impossible.
Mm-hmm. Ralph Nader and to some degree, for that matter, Paul Wellstone have talked about in recent months the need to build what amounts to a progressive third movement, not necessarily in Wellstone's case a third party, but a third movement designed, I suppose, primarily to move the Democratic Party as a whole a little bit to the left. Would you participate in an effort like that?
Well, I've got my hands full right now just learning the ropes to be a freshman United States Senator and work within with both the Democratic caucus there and also work, as I said earlier, collaboratively within the entire body of the Senate. I'm not nearly enough established even in Minnesota, much less nationally, to be proposing anything of that scope. You know, there are have been those undercurrents within the two parties for decades, and there have been attempts to set up another party, most recently Mr. Perot, and that's certainly, in my view, not produced a higher order of process or candidate, if Mr. Buchanan is the reflection of that. So, I mean, you know, there doesn't, you know, that, I mean, people make these things up as they go along, and there'll be continuing to be those kind of movements, and that's, I think, one of the great features of our process. It's very entrepreneurial. It's very wide open. It's very much an American system where people try to, you know, grab the bit in their mouth and go run with it. And so more power to them as long as they do it within the legal scope. And we'll see. We'll see what people want in the future.
But do you think the Democratic Party has sold its soul to the corporate dollar?
Well, I think the pressure is on candidates individually and the parties to raise huge amounts of money is just overwhelming our system. I mean, the amount of time, I think Senator Graham's and his campaign made the point too, Bill Luther would say the same, the amount of time they have to spend on the phone, dialing for dollars, asking for money from people who are not making charitable contributions, who are making contributions because they have, in almost all cases, a vested interest and want something in return in their own self-interest. I mean, we won't have democracy representing all the people if we have a system of financing which requires people to be beholden or to really at least conform their views to the views of these financial authorities. So, I mean, that's just got to be changed fundamentally, or it doesn't matter how many parties we have.
Laura, you're next, please.
Hi, thank you so much, and congratulations. I'm wondering if, in addition to the electoral college changes, that we need to look at partisans controlling elections. I mean, it's easy to see in the state of Minnesota what you could do if you had a partisan approach to elections. We'll put those polls in Duluth that they tend to, we always throw out 3% of those votes anyhow, so we can get up to 5%, or we'll throw those out. We'll understaff areas in North Minneapolis so people can't vote. Maybe we'll even take troopers and stop people, or we'll always make sure our candidate's name is first. We just had an election in this country where all the scientific and highly reliable models showed one candidate winning, and yet another one wins by the slimmest possible margin. This is, it's heartbreaking. And then, I mean, the big thing in here is you have a brother of the one candidate,
Laura,
controlling the election.
Laura, you've lost me here. Do you have a question?
My question is, do we need to look at our whole voting process instead of having a Republican or Democratic Secretary of State, do we need to make sure that our elections are run in an objective way by someone else other than a Secretary of State? Do we need to have extra safeguards? I mean, we've always thought that our democracy is great in this country, but maybe it's truly threatened.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we have to
All
look.
Right.
We have no ID at polling stations. Do
All
we
right.
know our voting process is good?
Let's get a comment here.
Well, I think our democracy is not threatened, Laura, but it's antiquated, and this election proves that. We do, I believe, this election shows need up-to-date, uniform, consistent, and reliable ways of conducting federal elections, rather than have each state and even in some cases even each county make its own decisions how it's going to handle things. So I think that's definitely part of what needs to come out of this experience.
One of the notable features of this election here in Minnesota and presumably around the country as well is the big gender gap that's developed in America. What's that all about? Why are so many women supporting Democrats relative to men and so many men supporting Republicans relative to women?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly not because we're better looking, I can attest from my experience. I don't know. That's a good question, Gary. I haven't even had time to sit down and look at the exit polls and do any kind of analysis, but I have that same question myself. I don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Social Security was a big issue during the Senate campaign here, and you made it clear that you don't really support the idea of privatizing Social Security. But when you get to Washington, if there is seems to be some bipartisan support for a plan to privatize at least part of the program, could you go along with that, or is that one of those issues that you draw a line in the sand on and say, don't tread on me?
Well, I'm open to learning more, and as one of my political heroes, Winston Churchill, once said, he said, I'd rather be right than consistent. So if I can be convinced that I'm not right and I don't have all the wisdom or knowledge, on a topic, I'll adjust my views accordingly. I just sincerely don't see at this point, based on the economic projections, based on the Social Security trustees, that the system is not in its present form sound financially and won't be for as long as the U.S. economy stays sound. So I don't know what we're, you know, can change it to without undermining the financial strength of the existing system. Now, you know, if Governor Bush is elected, he'll probably propose something along the lines of his 2% privatization, the 2% of the 12.4% FICA, and I'll certainly take a look at that. I'd have to be convinced. Again, I think the economists disagree whether there's sufficient funds to do that and do the other things that he wants to do and still protect Social Security, which to me is the bottom line. So I'm not going to rule anything out, but at this point, I sincerely, honestly, it's not campaign rhetoric, believe that the current system is in sound financial and it's the way people ought to be. And I said in the last debate that you hosted last Sunday, and I still believe this, that once the markets, financial markets, the stock market corrects, as it eventually will, at some point a downturn or even a recession, 20-25% stays there, and people get their margin calls and everything else and realize that their friendly stockbrokers are not so friendly when they owe them money, I think a lot of this support for privatization will lessen and maybe disappear when people remember why we set up Social Security to begin with, so people can have something they can absolutely rely on.
Suzanne, your question, please.
Yes, congratulations, Senator-elect Dayton.
Thank you, Suzanne.
And during the campaign, I think I remember you pledging to serve in the Congress for only $1. And I was wondering whether you've explored what happens to the other funds from your would-be salary, and whether it might be better to take the salary, redirect the money to the deficit or to another cause.
Well, it's a fair question, Laura. Suzanne, it's a fair question. I made that promise. I'm going to, after this campaign, check with my financial advisor to see if I can afford to keep it.
We do have a pledge week coming up here.
All right, there we go. Well, that would be, I couldn't think, there would be no better use for it than that. If I thought it could solve, of course, now we have a surplus to deficit. If I thought that it could take care of that, I'd gladly contribute it to the nation. But we'll see.
Let me ask you about race relations. Is there any one thing that should be done to make things better? Obviously, there probably be several things you could think about, but any one thing, any one place to start?
I think improving the quality of our public education is very much the underpinning of the assimilation of people from all different races and countries and cultures, religions, languages into this country and the state. I mean, Minnesota, we're so much more diverse than we were 10 and 20 years ago, and that's our great challenge and our great opportunity. And if people can succeed economically, individually, and without being pitted one against another, then I think there's hope over time that they will learn to live better together cooperatively and the like. I mean, you watch the Vikings play, for example, and when that touchdown pass is thrown, black, white, everyone else, they're together. I see that in high school sports. It's one of the great values of sports. If we can set up the situations in our society where people can succeed together, can be teammates, can be neighbors, can be spouses and partners, I think we'll accomplish that. If our economy continues to have, you know, great winners and serious losers, and we don't give people a chance of the hope and also the opportunity, as I said earlier, to earn the American dream, then I think we'll fail. So I think the educational system is just essential, and public education, in my view, is underfunded in Minnesota, is not recognized as such, and because of the scope of the challenges and the special needs of kids now, we just can't afford to fail at that.
Affirmative action, any time in the future, or perhaps now, when we can move away from affirmative action programs?
Well, I support affirmative action in the context that we have people who have historically been wronged in this country and who even now are being disadvantaged, discriminated against, and that we need to help them or give them the additional opportunities to, again, as I said earlier, achieve the American dream. That's where I think education is so key, because you can't provide too much education. You can't provide too much remedial education for those who are coming in disadvantaged or without the language or without the skills and the like. But you don't, you can only go so far, and the public will only support going so far. And that's why when you have quotas or you're saying somebody you lose in order somebody else can gain, when we get to that point, it gets to be destructive. And that's where I think we have to draw the line. That's why, again, if we can announce the prevention is worth a pound of cure, if we can put it in the educational system at the upfront, we're going to then allow people to achieve it on success on their own, and that should be our goal.
I think we have, what, 2 more years left to go, and then all the welfare recipients are going to hit that, or not all of them, but some welfare recipients will hit that 5-year lifetime limit. Should that be changed?
Well, it certainly is going to need to be reviewed at that point in time when, the, as you say, in 2002, when the bill is going to be reauthorized and when that first deadline is going to be reached. The welfare rolls have dropped in this country by about 50%, and I think that should underscore that a better economy and some of these job welfare-to-job programs, training, support systems, daycare, transportation, and the like, really do pay off. And so hopefully we can take a more enlightened view and recognize that there are going to be some people who are, through whatever physical or mental, emotional, other impairments, are not able to hold jobs in this society. And for their sake and for our sake, we don't want to put them in desperate straits and throw them on the streets and tell them your only way of, you know, surviving is to fend for yourself or start, you know, becoming an effective criminal. So I think there's a way to look at that and provide greater latitude, discretion to individual caseworkers to make those decisions rather than having something that's arbitrary and even draconian.
Mm-hmm.
And still keep the intent of the program and the success so far, which is those who can work should be encouraged to do so and required to do so.
There are a fair number of people in Minnesota, I suppose, wringing their hands right now saying, good Lord, Mark Dayton was elected. Now we have 2 flaming liberals in the U.S. Senate from Minnesota. Are you a follower?
I'm too old, Gary, at 53, and I'm certainly not in good enough shape to flame for, you know, I don't think labels are characterized either one of us fairly, and I'm certainly going to be my own person. I have a lot of respect for Paul. He's been a good friend for 20 years, but I got elected by the people of Minnesota independently of him, and I have a job to do in the best way I can see it. As I said the other night, I work for everybody come January 3rd. Everybody in Minnesota, they voted for me or didn't vote for someone else or didn't vote at all. And I'm going to do the best job I can on behalf of Minnesota businesses and Minnesota farmers and everyone else. And anyone individually who has a problem, I hope they'll contact my office. I hope we do a good job in response. And, you know, it's a job of serving everybody, and I'm going to do my best to do that for everyone.
Thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be here.
Minnesota Senator-elect Mark Dayton joining us on our midday program. If you missed part of the program, by the way, we'll be rebroadcasting this program at 9 o'clock tonight here on Minnesota Public Radio. Rebroadcast at 9. Well, that does it for our midday program today. Sarah Meyer is the producer of our program. Kara Figenshue is our assistant producer, and we had technical help this week from Clifford Bentley, Alan Strickland, and Steve Griffith. I'm Gary Acton. Thanks for joining us.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Care 11, host of Care11.com. 24-hour access to updated weather, radar, news, and traffic information. Care11.com.
Programming support comes from the financial contributions of listeners like you. Become a member online at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Talk of the Nation is next.
On the next All Things Considered, Green Party vice presidential candidate Winona LaDuke talks about her party's role in the current election chaos. It's All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. Cloudy sky, 32 degrees at KNWFM, 91.1 Minneapolis and St. Paul. Cloudy through the afternoon, temperature about as warm as it's going to get. Cloudy tonight with a low in the upper 20s. Tomorrow, more of the same, cloudy skies, mid-30s. On Sunday, though, the change, well, actually Saturday night, snow moves into the cities, so get ready.
From NPR News in Washington,